culture. And it's a question that Sean raised about whether whether this, well, it's related to the question that Sean raised. Is this kind of mentality that Lonergan's calling cosmopolitan, is it really possible? Is it possible for human beings to reach a state of objectivity, of self-transcendence, to use a later term of Lonergan, where they are too, their concern is too universal to be bribed, too impalpable to be forced, too effective to be ignored. Is it possible for us to reach a state where our concern is to make operative the timely and fruitful ideas that otherwise are inoperative and without the backing of power? As he says, so far from employing power or pressure or force, it has to witness to the possibility of ideas being operative without such backing. This is the issue that he's raising here, and it's an issue over against, for instance, a Marxist point of view, of whether or not this kind of native detachment is possible. I think it's impossible for us to get to that point. In later writings of Lonergan, he speaks about a scale of values. And vital values, food, clothing, shelter, and so on. The equitable distribution of vital goods to the whole community is a function of the social order. And the social order is a matter of the technological, economic, and political structures of the society and the intersubjective groups. So the social order is the dialectic of community. But the well-being of the social order, and this is the crucial thing, and the crucial link in his theory here, is dependent upon the cultural values, the meanings and values by which people live. And the emphasis in Lonergan's work is that we are capable of devoting ourselves to achieving genuine meanings and values that are not simply a reflex of economic interests. That genuine culture is possible. The genuine pursuit of the beautiful in song and story and dance and film and paint and so on and so forth. The genuine pursuit of the intelligible in science, of the true in philosophy, and so on. These things are possible, and they are not simply reflexes of group bias or whatever. So genuine culture, but the meanings and values by which a society lives determine the status of the social order. But for genuine cultural values, you've got to have persons of integrity or authenticity, so personal value. And it's genuine persons who promote the cultural values that will sustain the community to distribute the goods equitably. And of course, people cannot be people of integrity or authenticity without God's grace. And so you've got, it functions that way. Now the key to this thing, we can easily grasp that grace is necessary for integrity and authenticity. Any Christian will grant that. We can't do it on our own. It's only under the influence of grace that any kind of sustained integrity and sustained authenticity is possible. And we can easily grasp that the social order is what conditions the equitable distribution of the vital goods. What is hard to grasp is the point that he's making in this chapter when he talks about cosmopolis, and that he makes in the scale of values when he talks about cultural values. The integral role of culture in this whole thing, the pursuit of meanings and values, without any concern for their immediate payoff to this group, to that group, or whatever, but to the pursuit of what is in itself beautiful, intelligible, true, and good. That's the point that he's trying to make, and cosmopolis is the mentality that promotes that, that promotes genuine cultural values, simply because the questions give rise to the pursuit of certain values, and it would be inauthentic not to pursue those questions. Is that clear? And I think maybe that the business of the scale of values, it's a later way of fleshing out some of the same things. In my own work, the dialectic of community is the social. There's a dialectic of culture. I talk about a dialectic of culture. I don't want to go into this in detail here because that's not what we're dealing with. And then there's the dialectic of the subject is the personal values, the dialectic that we saw in the chapter 6. Chris? So could I conclude with, I don't know, you don't all have your books with you, I don't think it's a heavy book to carry around, but there's a final observation on method on pages 268 and 269, and I'm just going to read a couple of the paragraphs there, because it highlights the notion of dialectic and how important he regards the notion of dialectic that he's putting forth here. If you've got the book, it's on 268, I'm starting in the middle of page 268. A final observation has to do with method. From the beginning, we have been directing attention to an event that occurs within consciousness. Accordingly, our method has not been the method of empirical science, which draws its data from the field of sensible presentation. However, we have had occasion to speak of a generalized empirical method that stands to the data of consciousness as empirical method stands to the data of sense. All right, so that's what he's doing here. He's talking particularly up to this point the data of empirical consciousness and intelligent consciousness, experience and understanding. In the present chapter, the nature of this generalized method has come to light. As applied solely to the data of consciousness, it consists in determining patterns of intelligible relations that unite the data explanatorily. So all that material on the patterns of experience in chapter 6, biological, aesthetic, intellectual, dramatic. Data of consciousness organized by different patterns of experience. Such are the biological, artistic, dramatic, and intellectual forms of experience. Moreover, our previous studies of mathematical and of scientific thoughts would regard particular cases of the intellectual form of experience, the first five chapters. And similar differentiations could be multiplied. However, generalized method has to be able to deal, at least comprehensively, not only with the data within a single consciousness, but also with the relations between different conscious subjects, between conscious subjects and their milieu or environment, and between consciousness and its neural base. From this viewpoint, dialectic, this is a very important statement that he's making here, and it has not been followed through on the way it should have been. This is 50 years ago. Finished. Dialectic stands to generalized method as the differential equation to classical physics or the operator equation to the more recent physics. What he's saying is that dialectic is the key to human science, the notion of dialectic. And so the exploration and the development of the notion of dialectic is to human science what the differential calculus is. For dialectic is a pure form with general implications. It is applicable to any concrete unfolding of linked but opposed principles that are modified cumulatively by the unfolding. So within the individual, within the group, and I'm also talking about within the culture, it can envisage at once the conscious and the non-conscious, either in a single subject, neural demands and consciousness, or in an aggregate and succession of subjects. It is adjustable to any course of events, from an ideal line of pure progress resulting from the harmonious working of the opposed principles to working together, intersubjectivity, practical common sense working together, to any degree of conflict, aberration, breakdown, and disintegration. It constitutes a principle of integration for specialized studies that concentrate on this or that aspect of human living, and it can integrate not only theoretical work but also factual reports. And finally, by its distinction between insight and bias, progress and decline, it contains in a general form the combination of the empirical and the critical attitudes essential to human science. So I just want to point that out to you. It's a programmatic statement that he's making there, that the notion of dialectic that he's introduced here with the talk of the dialectic and the subject in chapter 6 and the dialectic of the community in chapter 7 stands to human science as the calculus stands to physics. It's the generalized heuristic that gives you the scope for processing the data in human science. Okay, so that's it's a programmatic statement, and as we say, I don't think it's been picked up on the issue, but I'm hoping that it will be. All right, that's the end of the discussion of common sense. Questions, discussion, anything further? Ready to move to things? Okay. So the notes then on chapter 8. This is moving to a very different discussion now. First thing that I would do is to recall some pertinent comments that, if you can remember, our first class or the second class of the semester, from the introduction to the book, because this is what's being picked up on in chapter 8. In each of us, there exist two different kinds of knowledge. Okay? There's the knowledge that is basically the knowledge of the animal, and then there's the knowledge that is the knowledge of a full human being. And the question of human knowledge is not whether it exists, but what precisely are its two diverse forms and what are the relations between them. And we're going to see this now in chapter 8 in the distinction between things and bodies. Or again in the introduction. St. Augustine narrates that it took him years to make the discovery that the name real might have a different connotation from the name body. Or, to bring the point nearer home, one might say that it has taken modern science 4 centuries to make the discovery that the objects of its inquiry need not be imaginable entities moving through imaginable processes in an imaginable space-time. Or again, the hard fact is that the psychological problem exists, that there exist in us 2 diverse kinds of knowing. That they exist without differentiation and in an ambivalent confusion until they are distinguished explicitly and the implications of the distinction are drawn explicitly. The hard fact is that the personal psychological problem cannot be solved by the ordinary procedure of affirming the propositions that are true and denying the propositions that are false. For the true meaning of the true propositions always tends to be misapprehended by a consciousness that has not yet discovered its need of discovering what an Augustine took years and modern science centuries to discover. But again, it's the 2 diverse forms of human knowing. And just pointing back to these things that he mentioned early on in the book, because chapter 8 is where this begins to be unfolded. And finally, unless one breaks the duality in one's knowing, one doubts that understanding correctly is knowing. That's full human knowing. Full human knowing is the correct understanding of experience. Okay, you've got 3 levels of experience, understanding, judgment. Full human knowing is the correct understanding of experience. So, correct understanding correctly is knowing. So, if under the pressure of that doubt, if one doubts that, if one thinks that knowing is taking a good look at what's already out there now, okay, just looking, if knowing is like looking rather than like correct understanding, under the pressure of that doubt, either one will sink into the bog of a knowing that is without understanding, and so one's cognitional, one's awareness of one's knowing will be purely on the empirical level. If you give an account of it, you'll say it's like looking. Okay. All right, now that, if you say your knowing is like looking, it's like taking a good look, then you are neglecting the role of understanding in knowing. So the bog of a knowing that is without understanding. Or one will cling to understanding, but leave out the correct part there, the judgment part. One will cling to understanding, but sacrifice knowing on the altar of immanentism, idealism, relativism. And the relativist, the idealist, the immanentist, they acknowledge understanding, they don't acknowledge judgment. From the horns of that dilemma, one escapes only through the discovery, again, the two forms of knowing. There are two quite different realisms. There is an incoherent realism, half animal and half human, that takes a good look at what's already out there now. And then there is an intelligent and reasonable realism, which is the full account here. Intelligent and reasonable, understanding and judgment, between which and materialism, the halfway house is idealism, focusing on only on understanding. That's a very complicated sentence, and we don't have to unpack all of that. I tried to do it earlier on. But the point is that we tend to have a spontaneous notion of human knowing as being a matter of taking a good look, seeing everything that's there, not seeing anything that isn't there. And that's knowing. But correct human knowing, full human knowing is correct understanding of experience. Understanding correctly is knowing. And that doesn't involve looking except at the level of experience. At the level of experience, looking is involved. But understanding and judgment are not to be conceived on the analogy of looking. They're quite distinct types of operations. They're not like taking a good look. Okay. So that's what this chapter, this number one, is just introducing us to the issue that will be raised in this chapter. There is the knowing that involves understanding, and there is the knowing that is simply a matter of biological extroversion, taking a good look. All right. So, numbers two to four deal with section one of chapter eight, the general notion of the thing. Chapter eight is one of the most important sections of the book. It brings to a close the concentrated attention to the second level of cognitional activity, so understanding, insight, will be going on in the next chapter to judgment, to the third level. The notion of a thing involves yet another kind of insight, an insight that grasps not relations between data, as in physics, for example, or relations of things to us, as in common sense, but a unity identity whole in data, in their concrete individuality and in the totality of their aspects. A thing is a unity to which there belongs every aspect of every datum within the unity. The clearest examples of what he means by things are plants, animals, and human beings. We get to the down into the chemical and bio and the atomic level, it's much more difficult to know whether you've got a unity identity whole or an aggregate. But plants, animals, and human beings are this unity identity whole in data to which there pertains everything about the unity identity whole. So 278, 279, by a thing is meant an intelligible concrete unity as differentiated by experiential conjugates, okay, color, and so on, and common sense expectations, it is a thing for us, a thing is described. As differentiated by explanatory conjugates and scientifically determined probabilities, is a thing itself, a thing as explained. So the notion of a thing that there is an insight that grasps a unity in data. And that unity is what is meant by thing here. From this grasp of unity in a concrete totality of data, there follow the various characteristics of things. Number one, they are extended in space. Spatially distinct data pertain to the unity at any given instant. So each one of us is spatial, okay? And spatially distinct data pertain to us at any given instant. They are permanent, or at least enduring, in time. Temporally distinct data pertain to the same unity. So I can have memories of what happened to me at age six. Still me, same unity identity whole, permanent in time, enduring in time. They are subject to change. There is a difference between the aggregate of data at one instant and at another. None of us is the same person that we were even yesterday. Things change. They possess properties and are subject to laws and probabilities. The conjugates are properties of the thing, and the probabilities regard the occurrence of changes in the thing. Conjugates now are, just think of his use of the term conjugates here as properties, if that's a word that is more familiar to you. They're related to the thing by attribution, so that some one person is tall and another one is short, and is fat and another one is thin. So these are experiential conjugates, properties. And you attribute them to the person. The notion of the thing is necessary for the notion of change. You can't really understand change without the notion of a thing, because a change is not just a newly observed datum, nor the substitution of one datum for another, nor the creation of a datum that previously did not exist. Moreover, there are no changes in the realm of abstractions, for every abstraction is eternal, whatever it is defined to be. And here's his point. If there is change, there has to be a concrete unity of concrete data extending over some interval of time. There has to be some difference between the data at the beginning and at the end of the interval. And this difference can be only partial, not a total difference, for otherwise there would occur not a change, but an annihilation and a new creation. The notion of the thing is also necessary for the continuity of scientific thought and development. Basic synthetic construct of scientific thought and development. We don't need to go into the analysis there, but if you want to look at it, it's on 273. And finally, things are said to exist. The notion of existence raises questions that he's not ready to face yet, but he says things are said to exist. Well, what properly really exists is the unity identity whole. I can say my hand exists, of course, but it doesn't exist independently. I exist as a unity identity whole, and my hand is a part of me. So it's things that are said properly to exist. Unities, identities, wholes are said to exist. Existence stands to the thing as event or occurrence stands to the conjugate, the property. For the existence of the thing is known by verifying the notion of the thing. So you know the existence of something by verifying the notion of that thing, as the occurrence is known by verifying the conjugate. And general knowledge of existence, like knowledge of occurrence, is obtained through statistical laws. And one more point, and I will pause here. This is on the general notion of the thing. While all existing things are particular, we can abstract from their particularity and speak both of things in general and of things of determinate kinds, specified by their conjugates or properties. Later on in the chapter, he'll take up this, that there are different kinds of things, and that's the notion of genus and species. Different kinds of things specified by their conjugates or properties. The conjugates may be experiential or explanatory, but there are data on things only in as much as they are related to our senses. And so it follows, and this is the point now, this is what is going to bring us into the two different forms of human knowing. That there can be no appeal to data as long as one is considering things themselves, things as explained, things as related to one another, things as equivalent for all observers, in as much as one prescinds from all observers. When there is no possibility of observation, there is no possibility of a verifiable image. For the imagined as imagined can be verified only when what is imagined can also be sensed. Accordingly, there can be no verifiable images for subatomic elements. Okay. But if subatomic elements cannot be imagined, then atoms, now always put in here as explained, atoms as explained cannot be imagined. If atoms as explained cannot be imagined, then by parity of reasoning, molecules as explained cannot be imagined. If molecules as explained cannot be imagined, neither can cells as explained. If cells as explained cannot be imagined, neither can plants as explained. Once one enters upon the way of explanation by relating things to one another, one has stepped out of the path that yields valid representative images. There will be other images, mathematical formulae and all of that sort of thing, okay? And the point that he's trying to make is that that doesn't mean, just because you can't verify by looking, or something similar to looking, that it isn't knowing. You see the point that, that he's making here? The thing as explained is not imaginable. The thing as described is imaginable. The thing as explained is not. Explanatory knowledge. You look perplexed.
I am.
I don't know, but I was watching a thing about string theory. And string theory, they've figured out mathematically that they think there might be these tiny little strings that make up everything. And it unifies the theory of relativity and quantum mechanics. But the little strings are so small that there is no way actually to see them with a microscope or to do experiments. They haven't figured out experiments either of how to do this. So a lot of people are saying, well, now this is philosophy, it's not science anymore because we can't see them. Mm-hmm. Is that the same?
It's a perfect example of what he's talking about.
This is what he's talking about. So he said they might actually exist.
They can be affirmed to exist if you can verify the formulations then there's a likelihood that they're onto something.
Okay, but even you don't have to verify by looking? So you never have to see them, but you can be pretty sure, or you can know them.
Because you can verify by saying, all right, what are the implications of affirming this? And then you do test after test after test, and if those implications all come out and work, then it's adding substance to the hypothesis. Mm-hmm. So, but you'll never be able to see them. Mm-hmm. It's a perfect example of what he's talking about. When the thing is explained, okay, is not imaginable, and yet it may be real, because of it, the real is the verified. Mm-hmm. That's the point. The real is not what I can imagine. The real is not what I can know by looking. The real is what can be verified. And it's the mind that works out the implications that ground verification.
So you could verify something mathematically and not need to ever see them by looking. Okay.
That's precisely the point that he's making. And if the verification continues to work, you're adding more and more substantiation to the hypothesis. But it's probably true. That's a perfect example. Thank you. Sean.
Isn't that the same thing he was talking about in the earlier chapters with conceptualization?
Yeah.
You can't conceptualize a line.
Right.
You can't imagine a line.
That's right.
But you can conceptualize.
That's right.
That's
right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So does Chris?
So this notion of the thing, like the things are very. It seems to me a very, I think is a loaded word maybe. So I'm just trying to wrap my mind around this. So it seems that like fundamentally for him, is this right, that a thing, his notion of a thing is grounded in the canon of parsimony. What is that, like all this talk about verification, so mm-hmm. It's like.
So you don't affirm what you can't verify.
Right, and in that sense then, it seemed to me like this thing was, notion of a thing was taking on like a heuristic function that that the thing itself enables us to understand our relationship to what is real. Yes? Because like when you start talking about things, like you said, like my hand is an aggregate. It's not a unity identity whole. I'm the unity identity whole. Well, if you cut off the hand and the hand's laying it there and you consider the hand in itself apart, not relative to you, that would be maybe a unity identity.
Maybe. See, Lizzie, you get into lots of questions.
Yeah.
There are lots of questions.
Well, that's right. So like, these are all the questions that are coming up. So cut off your hand, take away consciousness. What makes you a unity identity whole? Do you know what I'm getting at?
Oh, I know exactly what you're getting at. Yeah. I can't answer the question.
Why can't you answer the questions?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the answer. That's why.
I'm wondering if you're going to have.
If I knew, I could answer them. I don't know the answer.
I'm just wondering, because if you're going to have a chapter on things, don't you have to answer those questions?
Yes, the chapter is a heuristic that's pointing in the direction. But then you got to sit down. There's an article I should have actually, maybe if someone will remind me, I'll photocopy it for you next time. Paul Kidder has done an article, and he raises a lot of questions like you're raising right now. And is X a thing and is Y a thing and so on and so forth. And gives you the pros and cons of these things. That's why I said, I weaseled out by saying that the easiest instances are plants, animals, and human beings of what he means by it.
Because the greater significance, it seems for me, is that without answering those questions, it's like, okay, things, we need to talk about things because it enables us to understand reality is intelligible, and it allows us to understand what is intelligible.
Right.
But if we don't answer those questions, it seems to me that that there is the possibility that there are shadows of intelligibility that aren't being answered.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
I don't know whether I'd say it's shadows of intelligibility, but there are things that we don't know yet.
When I just think, like, what I'm suggesting is maybe that there are things that we don't know because in the way that we're conceiving our knowing or going about our knowing is that we're preventing ourselves from knowing things that could be known.
Things?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's exactly right.
I'm not sure that I'm getting the last point that you made. Can you put it in another way? I mean, you mean that this notion itself may be preventing us from...
No, I appreciate the notion. I'm just saying that those questions seem to me to, like, open up a lot of other questions.
Yeah, okay.
That's it.
Okay.
I'll read that.
I have no problem with that. I would agree with that. I can't answer a lot of those other questions. I'm not even going to try to. The point that he's making here is the difference between the thing as described and the thing as explained. And that's what I want in this number four on here, that's what I want to make sure that we get. And that's why I appreciated so much Dorothy's example of the string theory, because if the theory is repeatedly, cumulatively verified, even though you'll never see these strings, it keeps adding substantiation to the hypothesis. It makes it more and more probable that it's true.
Yes.
If the verification, and the verification can be the verification of mathematical formulae, but our minds are capable of constructing the conditions for verification. If A, then B, and then you test it and you see. And so a thing can be, something can be affirmed even though it cannot be imagined or can't be looked at or whatever. The thing as described is something that's imagined. A tree as described is a tree. They're both valid forms of knowing. Okay? But the point that he's making here is that the thing as explained. Part of the pertinence of this in terms of the history of philosophy is that this is Lonergan's response to Kant's distinction of the noumenon and the phenomenon. Instead of the noumenon, the thing in itself, which we can never know, and the phenomenon, which is the appearance, and that's all that we do know. For Lonergan, you have the thing as explained, and the thing as described, and both of those are knowledge. So the distinction there, does that make sense?
Yes. I was thinking of like examples that you hear about in science or that I've heard in science. I don't know anything about science, but examples of like you ask one question and the data responds one way, like real, and it can be verified one way, you ask another, the data responds, there's these kinds of participation things. Do you know what I'm saying?
So like light being particles sometimes, mm-hmm. being waves others?
Yeah, exactly. Like so that's exactly what I'm talking about. It's like, so if we're conceiving things this way, heuristically, verifying, enabling, knowledge, understanding, maybe there's a possibility that if we ask the question another way, the world's going to respond in a different way.
And maybe there's the possibility that if we keep pursuing the questions, that there'd be an integration of the different ways to respond.
I'm not sure whether what you're asking is, okay, because it seems to me that with this notion of the thing, the question that I would have is, how do we recognize the unity, identity, and hope? I mean, what is unity, identity, and hope?
Well, see, that's why I used the clearest examples of it, of a plant, and an animal, and a human being. Is that you have an insight that everything that's pertinent belongs to that unity, identity, hope. So you recognize it by an insight.
Somehow, it seems to me that there is something missing there.
What?
A stupid example. Like if you take a human being, right, and a human being is breathing all the time.
Is what?
Is breathing all the time.
Right.
Exchanging in and out, taking air in and out all the time.
Right.
I would think that that air is a thing in itself. But on the other hand, it's also a thing that becomes part of the person, at least for a specific period of time. You know what I mean? It's the notion of whole and unity, and it's not very clear to me. Because things can be more united. I mean, one thing can be united to other things.
No, I think on his analysis that the air would be a lot of things. Not the air that I breathe in is one thing that I'm breathing in. And then the science would answer the question of how that is made a part of me and so on and so forth. Scientific analysis would fill that out. But it would be a lot of things. The problem with that is that I can't specify what those things are because I don't know the scientific.
But even, I mean, isn't all he's saying here that a thing is part of our cognitive apparatus?
That's right. Right?
Yes. So we go out, we face the world trying to make things. And some of those things that we make are primarily descriptive and some of them are explanatory. It doesn't.
That's the affirmation of the first section of the book. That in addition to insights into the relations between different aspects of data and so on, we have insight into unities.
Right.
The insights can be descriptive or explanatory. And the explanatory insights do not, they may be valid even though we can't imagine the terms of reference.
That's right. But to some extent, wouldn't it, so that what I decide to be, what I, on the explanatory level, what I choose to claim is a thing becomes influenceable by theory.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. My explanatory. It's like when I'm. Like we were saying before, it's things and relations. Like when I have a theory, it's things and relations. It's self-defining. So the same thing happens here. So if I can have a theory in which the severed hand is a thing, but it pertains to that theory, and I have a theory in which I have to have the whole human to make it a thing.
Does he later broaden the concept of thing beyond the level of proportion of being, beyond the data of sense? Like, is an angel a thing? But here he talks about being extendable in space and time.
Yeah.
Does he do that later?
He does in the Trinitarian. There's an extension of it, or a, in the Trinitarian treatise, when he deals with the notion of supposit in the Trinitarian, and he'll talk about minerals, plants, animals, human beings, angels, and the three divine persons. Also.
Right. So these properties of things are things at the level of data of sense.
Yeah, at the level of data of sense.
Yeah,
the properties here are at the level of data of sense.
So, by things he means created things.
Here, yes.
Okay.
No, by things he means created things. Yeah. He uses there's the notion of supposit in the Trinitarian. And a lot of the, this is getting a little complicated for the, but yeah, he's talking about, he's not even raised the issue of creation, of course, at this point. It's a theological notion, but he's talking about within the data of our experience, and within the data of sense, and they're extended in space and perduring in time. But it will be generalized into the notion of substance and supposit and so on, and then it will be extended to spiritual unities. It's the Aristotelian Tomist notion of the unum per se. But the unum per se, or the substance, there's a problem with the notion of substance, and Aristotle and Tomist says that's come down to us. We think of a substance as something that's already down there now that supports all of these. He's trying to get at something that is not out there, down there, up there, or anywhere, but that is intelligent. Okay? So it's a concrete unity identity, home to which there belongs every aspect of every datum that is a part of it. And it can be known descriptively and explanatorily, either way. And that's the point that he's making in the first section of the chapter. Can we just contrast, Ravi?
Yeah, I just kind of remember that the understanding of being is a point where he says that the notion of the thing includes much more than simply unity, identity, whole. I'm not sure if that's right. I'm trying to look for it here.
Okay, if you find that. Yeah. I haven't checked it, nor have I listened to that particular MP3.
Yeah, so that's why I was having.
Okay, if you
I
get it,
okay.
If you get it, bring it up. Okay. I think what I'm going to do is just take the notion of the body, which is the next. Concluding this page and going to page 3 will take us through the notion of body, and then we can. Oh no, we're not even. No, let's stop. We've only got 5 minutes, and I think I'll be clearer, and my head will be less stuffed up. You got it? Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think it's Well, what he says here is this. Well, this is lecture 4, and it's emotional the thing.
Okay.
However, the expression unity, identity, whole is not an adequate account of the notion of a thing, because we have not yet treated judgment and the notion of being. What he said about the thing in chapter 8 of Insight is not complete. Chapter 8 aims at a characterization of the notion of the thing as a unity, identity, whole, discerning individual data.
Okay, yeah.
And
that's really all that he's presenting in this chapter. In other words, what he's saying there is that by the time you get down to the chapters on metaphysics, that the notion will be extended far beyond what we have here. So you'll have central act, for instance, existence, and so on. But let's postpone that for now. I'm glad you called it. I'm sorry if I lost communication a couple of times. I'm not feeling well. Well, he's doing, I think that the book itself is a phenomenology of intelligence and rationality. Fred Crowe has written an article recently for a phenomenology of rationality. One of the points that Bonnegut makes is that a lot of phenomenology doesn't go far enough. It does the phenomenology of perception.
And I was thinking, wait a minute, do we need a string theory? Because it's the same.
I just have a little bit left.
Can't burn.